It is believed that over 1,000 Space Marine chapters, independent, autonomous armies, fight the Emperor's wars. 9 are named for the legions that remained loyal to the Emperor during the Horus Heresy. Others are successor chapters, brotherhoods who can claim genetic descent from the 9 loyal Primarchs. These are the 9 original Loyalist chapters. Ultramarines. The Ultramarines epitomize what it means to be Adeptus Astartes. They are beacons of nobility, honor, and discipline in a galaxy riven by darkness and disorder. No chapter holds the Codex Astartes in such hallowed regard as they, and they have utilized its tenets and strategies to achieve glorious victories over 10,000 years. Few, if any, chapters can match the efficiency, speed, and skill with which the Ultramarines apply their deep learning of the Codex tactics and strategies. On countless battlefields, the Ultramarines have outwitted, outfought, and outmaneuvered their enemies, striking repeatedly with gene-wrought might until the foe is utterly vanquished. Ultramarines live and breathe the Codex Astartes. For 10 millennia have they learned and practiced its teachings, paying close attention to the most minute of details. Many Ultramarines can recite swaths of the text by heart, as well as produce lengthy treatises demonstrating a full understanding of its teachings. They have quashed heretic uprisings, swept aside piratical raids of murderous Drakari, purged verminous Hrud infestations, and shattered voracious Tyranid invasions. They have won victories for ages in scorching deserts, stifling jungles, labyrinthian ruined cities, and even in the depths of the oceans. These they have achieved in horrific sieges, grueling guerrilla warfare, and armored conflicts of such a scale that the wreckage fields can be seen from orbit. The Ultramarines' homeworld is of Macragge, a bastion of civilization, learning, and culture. It has been their base of operations since their Primarch, Rabute Gilliman, was united there with the Emperor during the Great Crusade. Heavily fortified, it is the jewel in the crown that is the Ultramarine Stellar Empire, known as Ultramar. This grouping of worlds and systems pays no tithe to Terra, their resources dedicated to supporting the Ultramarines. Nonetheless, such is the skill with which this region is organized, Ultramar is able to provide troops and material for the aid of the beleaguered Imperium. The Ultramarines shattered High Fleet Behemoth in the First Tyrannic War, many of the chapter's greatest heroes losing their lives to halt the Xenos fury. They clashed with the Black Legion heretic Astartes within the walls of the Fortress of Hera, their own fortress monastery, fighting with peerless zeal. All the vile might of Nurgle's plague legions and Mortarion's disease-ridden ranks of Death Guard have not been enough to break the Ultramarines, no matter the fell diseases and maladies thrown at them. As large and as powerful as Ultramar is, this makes it a prized hungered after by some of the Imperium's deadliest enemies. And the Ultramarines have been forced to fiercely defend it many times. The Ultramarines are commanded by some of the greatest space marines in the Imperium. Marnius Kalgar, the Chapter Master, is a superlative warrior and talented strategist. Long is his list of victories. He crushed the orcs in the Siege of Zalathras, defeated an Eldari Avatar at the Battle of Orar's Sepulchre, and led the masterful defense of Vigilus, engaging Abaddon the Despoiler himself in single combat. Tigurius is the Ultramarine's chief librarian, a battle psyker and warrior scholar of formidable intellect and insight, whose word is of greater value than armies of spies, strategists, and tacticians. Ortan Cassius, the Master of Sanctity, is the Ultramarine's oldest living space marine. It was he who established the Ultramarine's Tyrannic War veterans and has made it his personal mission to see the Tyranids erased from existence. It has not gone unnoticed amongst the Imperium's highest echelons that despite being the author of the Codex Astartes and the loudest voice for the breaking up of the huge Space Marine legions in the very distant past, Rabute Guilliman is now the only individual in the Imperium capable of commanding the loyalty of so vast a force of arms. A great many of the Ultramarines' successor chapters regard him as their spiritual liege. Even those that have strayed from the teaching of the Codex to some degree, or have embraced their homeworld's culture more, hold him in the highest regard. Those who are particularly learned believe that the combined strength of the Ultramarines' successors may well exceed that of the Ultramarines Legion at the height of the Great Crusade. Of course, no such comments are made to the Lord Commander of the Imperium in person, and little in his absence, in the event his agents hear. What Guilliman thinks of this is unknown to all but the risen Primarch himself. But an individual of such awe-inspiring intellect is unlikely to have missed such a detail. Despite these concerns, the overwhelming view held in the Imperium is a simple one. The Ultramarines and their successors have served the Imperium, the Emperor, and all of mankind with honor and loyalty for millennia, and continue to do so. With humanity under threat from all sides, such forces are vital to the human race's very survival. Imperial Fists. The Imperial Fists have stood as steadfast defenders of the Imperium since the Great Crusade. Strong of mind and spirit, they are the Emperor's shield, indomitable and unbreakable. Their stubbornness in the face of any enemy, and their determination to hold no matter the cost, is matched only by their zealous efforts to see their Gene Sire's dreams for the Imperium made real. The Primarch of the Imperial Fists was Rogel Dorn, whose name is revered throughout the Imperium. And from him stem the chapter's proud history and traditions. After being torn from Terra and cast into the galaxy, the Emperor discovered Dorn years later on the ice world of Inwit. Like many of his brothers, he had risen to lord of his people and had established a stellar empire of his own. Recognizing the Emperor as his father and liege, he presented the Master of Mankind with Phalanx, an immensely powerful and mobile space station that dated back to the Age of Technology. The Emperor handed to Dorn the Imperial Fists Legion, created using Dorn's own genetic material. The Emperor also insisted the Primarch keep Phalanx, and ever since, it has been the Imperial Fists' flagship and primary fortress. Dorn discovered his sons to be peerless crusaders and resolute warriors, firm in their commitment to order, unwilling to give ground, and unhesitating in making the ultimate sacrifice for victory. Their talent for siegecraft was undeniable, though they had achieved glorious victories in all manner of warfare. The Emperor later declared Dorn and his legion to be his Praetorians and tasked them with fortifying the Sol system, Terra, and the Imperial Palace itself. Ever since, the Imperial Fists have been known as the Defenders of Terra, a title they bear with immense pride. Their official homeworld, 10,000 years later, remains Terra itself, though the demands of war ensure the Imperial Fists now almost never return. Dorn saw the Imperium being built by the Emperor's legions as a fortress, with each world a part of a galactic system of ramparts, bulwarks, and counterguards. He laced the worlds the Imperial Fists conquered with mighty bastions and constructed vast orbital citadels around them, naming this system the Bastion Imperialis. When the Horus Heresy struck and world after world fell in with the traitors or was conquered by them, he saw each fall as a deep crack in his design. The tireless efforts of Rogel Dorn and the Imperial Fists to fortify the Sol system paid dividends during the Siege of Terra, turning the Imperial Palace into one of the most formidable fortresses the Imperium had ever seen. The Imperial Fists fought unwaveringly in the fighting, holding the walls and throwing back traitor assaults. Dorn teleported with the Emperor to engage Horus aboard the traitor's flagship, but was separated from his father before the duel that decided the fate of the Imperium took place. Bitterness and a deep sense of failure came to define his character for some time, and it took much to convince him to break his legion down into chapters following Rabute Gilliman's publication of the Codex Astartes. For 10,000 years, the Imperial Fists have been a symbol of Imperial defiance, in the face of all the myriad threats posed to humanity. They have played a vital role in the preservation of the Imperium, thousands of their number sacrificing themselves on battlefields the galaxy over. Rarely will a warrior of the Imperial Fists boast of such deeds, however. For them, the performance of such acts ranks far higher in importance than the declaring of them. Though not secretive and mysterious like the Dark Angels, they also do not possess the brash, loud, and forthright nature of the Space Wolves. The Imperial Fists often appear humorless and severe to those who encounter them, but they are nonetheless passionate warriors, determined, firm, and believing still in the great cause of Rogel Dorn's Bastion Imperialis. For them, it is said, the Great Crusade is yet to be completed. Whilst this goal is rarely spoken of aloud by the Imperial Fists, doubtless it is one that scarcely leaves their minds as they wage war. Sacrifice and commitment are huge elements of the Imperial Fists' ideals. They refuse to give ground to the foe, on occasion to their detriment. Phalanx's Librarius has records of many destroyed Imperial Fist forces that could have well have been saved were it not for stubbornness. Though it is without any doubt that many more victories have been won thanks to this trait, which runs so deeply through them. The Imperial Fists have a deep well of recruit reserves with which to replace their fallen brothers. Drawn from a multitude of worlds to allow for the high casualties they frequently suffer. While their chaplains teach of the need to manage excessive pride to avoid catastrophic losses, the determination to never give up holds a vice-like grip over every Imperial Fist's hearts. In terms of their combat doctrine, many Imperial Fists spend a disproportionately long period of time in fire support roles, serving in Hellblaster squads, Devastator squads, and Aggressor squads. This is due to their preference for heavy firepower, the emphasis they place on marksmanship, and the hellish siege battles they so often fight. In the time of the Era Indomitus, the Imperial Fists have fought battle after battle to break the forces of the arch enemy, relieve populations besieged by hordes of ravening Xenos, and recapture fallen worlds. Blood Angels, resplendent in their chapters gleaming red, the Blood Angels have fought for the Emperor since the first founding. They are amongst the most noble Space Marine chapters, seeking to always protect the weak and vulnerable. Yet, this deep sense of integrity and honor is besmirched by a hideous curse they conceal from all outsiders and ever strive to resist. Little is known of the Blood Angels' earliest history. Sanguinius was discovered during the Great Crusade on Baal Secundus, the second moon of the planet Baal. Though Baal and its moons were once glorious places of wealth and breathtaking architecture, during the Dark Age of Technology, all was destroyed. They were left as irradiated husks, inhabited by a small human population and savage mutants. After his pod crashed there, Sanguinius was a god to the near feral inhabitants, a figure of incomparable nobility and beauty in a place of suffering, death, and ugliness. This, despite his angelic wings, which nearly led the tribes to slaughter him upon his discovery. When the emperor finally reached the Ball system, Sanguinius accepted him as his liege without question and took command of the 9th Legion. Little detail survives of the Legion's involvement in the Great Crusade itself, besides a handful of honorifics and generic articles praising the Blood Angel's successes, almost all from the time after Sanguinius was placed at the head of his sons. What is clear is that Sanguinius was regarded as one of the greatest of the emperor's sons. Beautiful in mind and body, he was a warrior almost without peer, and a leader who could inspire incredible feats of personal courage, not just within his own legion, but throughout the vast multitudes of the emperor's varied servants. It is believed that the Blood Angel's legion fought by their Primarch's side throughout the Horus Heresy, though the only battle in the historical record they can be accurately placed at is the Siege of Terra. The conflict that defined the next 10,000 years of humanity's history. It is said that it was only after a long and arduous journey, battles of which are now lost to history, that the Blood Angels reached Terra to defend the throne world from the forces of the arch-traitor Horus. They fought with honor and courage and slew countless foes on the battlements of the Imperial Palace. But the cost of their efforts was great. In the final, desperate attack against Horus's flagship, the Vengeful Spirit, Sanguinius engaged the War Master in personal combat. In that titanic duel, he was slain. The 9th Legion shared a deep bond with their Primarch, perhaps one deeper than most of the Legion's Astartes had with their Genesire. For all Blood Angels at that time were injected with droplets of Sanguinius's blood. Some Blood Angels believe it is this, combined with the Primarch's death, that caused the flaw that has cursed every Blood Angel ever since. Partial fragments discovered in hidden corners of the Legion's Librarius that suggest some Blood Angels legionnaires suffered from a version of the flaw even before Sanguinius's death have been dismissed as false and locked away. The flaw takes two forms: the Red Thirst and the Black Rage. Every Blood Angel has deep within them an insatiable battle lust and hunger for blood. This is the Red Thirst, and it afflicts every gene son of Sanguinius in every waking moment. Though they take great pains to resist its lure, not all are successful, and no few Blood Angels succumb to it in the midst of battle. Doing so renders them truly deadly, to the extent that some attempt to control it and use it. Though a curse, The red thirst humbles the blood angels. It makes them aware of their own weaknesses, and thus more understanding of those and others. For all the horror of the red thirst, the black rage is far worse. When this takes over the blood angel's mind, it is irreversible. The blood angels believe that all will succumb to it should they not die first. Death is the only cure. Ingrained in the blood angel's gene seed is the encoded experience of their primarch, the strongest of which is his duel with Horus. On the eve of battle, an event or circumstance will trigger this memory in a blood angel. The battle brother's mind is taken over by this experience, and to those around him, he appears crazed with berserk fury, no longer aware of where or who he is. These brothers are assigned to the Death Company to meet an honorable end in battle. The worst thing of all about these twin curses is that with each passing year, more brothers succumb to them. The blood angels and their successors, all of whom are afflicted in the same way, are dying out, some at a faster rate than others. Few would be surprised if a chapter afflicted in such a way would fall to disrepair. Yet the blood angels do not. They fight on. They charge headlong into the guns of the enemy, eager to slay them in hand-to-hand combat. They honor their Primarch's belief that the galaxy can be changed for the better. This is epitomized in the transformation of recruits into Space Marines. The rad-scarred aspirants drawn from the Ball system undergo an apotheosis. They spend a year in slumber in ancient sarcophagi, in which time they receive their implants to become Space Marines. They emerge as demigods, tall, strong of muscle, keen of sense, and beautiful in body, the image of Sanguinius himself. Their desire to perfect and improve things manifests in every aspect of the Blood Angel's existence, from the elaborate embellishments many sport on their armor, the exquisite craftsmanship of their weapons, and their incredible skill with bolter and blade. In these dark times, the Blood Angels represent all that humanity can be. Despite, or because of, their terrible flaws, they are paragons of virtue and duty, serving as inspiration for all in the Imperium. White Scars. The roaring of furious engines, deep rumbles of thundering armored transports, screaming of heavy jump packs at full burn, and ferocious scorching war cries herald the devastating assault of the White Scars. Formidable hunters drawn from fierce tribesmen, the White Scars smash through their foes like the tip of a spear through the flank of prey. The White Scars are masters of lightning warfare and hit-and-run attacks. They stalk their prey patiently and relentlessly before striking at the weakest point with incredible precision, ferocity, and speed. They have inherited this martial legacy from the harsh culture of their homeworld, as well as from their Primarch, Ugatai Khan, known as the Warhawk, the Khagan, and the Khan of Khans. The White Scars hail from Chogoris, a world of windswept plains and jagged mountains. Its nomadic population are expert hunters and horsemen, and are persistently at war. This harsh lifestyle produces hard people, and therefore aspirants of high quality for the White Scars. It is among these people that Ugatai grew up, learning and embodying their ways. After his discovery during the Great Crusade, he imbued the 5th Legion with the traditions of Chogoris, and in doing so, bound his sons to him. To this day, the White Scars hang furs, Chogorian trinkets, and shamanistic fetishes from their armor, ritually scar their faces with tribal heraldry, and go to battle bearing the severed heads of their enemies. Thanks to these trappings, many mistakenly believe the White Scars to be backwards or even barbarous. The White Scars' manner of war is tightly controlled, however. As hunters, they carefully observe the lay of the land, striking only when they are ready. Off the battlefield, though they train as hard as any other Space Marines in the art of war, they are highly cultured. Many White Scars seek mastery in one or more of the noble pursuits set down by the Khagan. For some, this is hunting. For others, Khorchan calligraphy, or the telling of ancient tales. A rare few embrace the challenge of Psyverse. These skills are vital in making the White Scars better warriors. The patience required to paint a perfect character of Khorchan's script is the same patience that makes for an adept hunter. Even killing is an act of beauty to them, a demonstration of unity between warrior and weapon. The White Scars are also possessed of a strong sense of honor and justice, another legacy from their Primarch and the tribes of Chogoris. Deep mysticism and superstition form an integral part of Chogorian tribal culture, and so too are they embraced by the White Scars. The chapter's warriors place a great deal of trust in their librarians, who they call Storm Seers, calling upon these battle psychers for the enlightened wisdom they have accumulated over years of study. In battle, Storm Seers command the elemental fury of the tempest. Gales flow at their instruction, and lightning bolts strike the foe at their behest. This appears to have been so for almost all of their history, according to those few with knowledge on the matter. They suggest that the White Scars argued in favor of retaining the Space Marine Legion's Librarius in the fabled Council of Nicaea during the Great Crusade. Some believe that it was here that the Emperor prohibited the Space Marines' use psychic powers before the Horus Heresy. Though the horror of that terrible conflict necessitated reinstating the Librarius. The White Scars' battle tactics are highly fluid. The warriors of Chogoris repeatedly utilizing feints, staged retreats, and flanking attacks to destroy the foe. Speed is a key component of their strategies, and every White Scar strike force brings with it a host of bikes, armored transports, and jump packs. Few things give a son of the Warhawk greater joy than roaring across the battlefield, blade in hand, to bring death to the Emperor's enemies, often laughing as they strike their foes down. At the head of every White Scar's company is a Khan, a mighty warrior, calculating strategist, and superb duelist who has proven himself on the battlefield countless times. Where multiple Khans take to the field, they compete for overall command of the White Scar's force. In doing so, they both seek to earn honor for their company, known to the White Scars as a brotherhood, as well as for the sheer pleasure of rivalry amongst brothers. Thanks to a Khan's cunning tactics, a White Scar's force breaks apart and scatters their enemies, putting them to flight. In this moment, their hunting skills come to the fore as they pursue the foe and slaughter them all. The White Scars battle in the Era Indominus with all the strength available to them, taking the fight to the forces of Chaos and the Xenos Menace. The Yasan sector, in which their homeworld resides, has come under ferocious attack by the forces of Chaos pouring from the Maelstrom. Chogoris itself was besieged by the renegade space marines of the Red Corsairs, led by their warlord, Huron Blackheart. But the White Scars held firm and drove the traitors from their world, and the chapter's brotherhoods have since fought in the Vigilus, Asmar, Shinna, and Onragua systems. Though these times are fraught with perils beyond imagining, the White Scars refuse to be cowed, just as they never have in all their glorious history. Dark Angels. The Dark Angels were the First Legion. No other Space Marine Brotherhood has served the Emperor for as long as they have. Staunch defenders of mankind, they are merciless in the attack and stubborn in the defense. They are also shrouded in mystery, however, and have secrets so shameful they are kept even from many of their own number. The Dark Angel's name is held equally in awe and fear by those they fight for and against. They are not regarded in the same light as their brothers in the Ultramarines or Blood Angels. They are famed less for their honor and nobility than their unsettling demeanor, taciturn manner, inscrutability, and solemnity. Those who have fought beside the Dark Angels observe the deliberate detachment the chapter exhibits, and the rapid disappearance of its warriors as soon as their mission is achieved, sometimes even before the war is concluded. The Dark Angels are a fleet-based chapter, crossing the void in their armada of warships, and at its head, the mysterious fortress monastery known as the Rock. Few know how this colossal, void-born citadel came to be, or why the Dark Angels' former homeworld of Caliban no longer exists, and they would fight and die to keep the truth from the remainder of the Imperium. To fully understand the Dark Angels, it is necessary to learn of their Primarch, Lion L. Johnson, and his greatest friend, Luther. When the Emperor came to Caliban after the Lion's discovery, Luther was too old to join the First Legion as a Space Marine. The Lion left him the vital charge of defending Caliban and raising new generations of Space Marines. But Luther's heart grew bitter. When the Horus Heresy ended and the Lion returned to Caliban, Luther and the Dark Angels he commanded opened fire. Luther's strength was swelled by that of the Dark Gods of Chaos, and was thus the Lion's every equal in combat. Only once Luther had mortally wounded the Lion did he realize his calamitous mistake. As Luther cried out in anguish, a warp rift consumed Caliban, tearing the planet apart and sweeping thousands of the traitorous Dark Angels into the Empyrean. They would later be regarded as the Fallen. The surviving Dark Angels vowed to pursue the traitors and keep these events secret, believing the Imperium would damn them all should the truth become known. Embracing the Codex Astartes with little complaint so as to avoid suspicion, they and their successors referred to themselves as the Unforgiven, retaining close ties with each other, and fighting the Imperium's wars with distinction, even as they went about their own clandestine mission. Over time, the Inner Circle formed, made up of only the Dark Angels aware of the chapter's terrible secrets. Only a battle brother who has earned their trust and fought bravely on the battlefield may join their number, and even then they are told but a fraction of the whole damning truth. Whilst the hunt for the Fallen is of incredible importance to the Dark Angels, the great majority of their wars have little to do with their traitorous brethren. Following the Codex in its entirety, besides two specialist companies, the Veteran Deathwing and the rapid-striking Ravenwing, the Dark Angels fight in the manner of most Space Marine chapters. Lightning assaults, combined armed forces, and tactical flexibility are at the core of the Dark Angels' way of war. Every battlefield is searched for sedition, however. Though only the Inner Circle understand the signs of the Fallen, the uninitiated can still recognize heresy where they see it. In these tumultuous times, the Dark Angels have been at the forefront of some of the galaxy's most significant wars. The Sons of Caliban have bled their foes in the Stygius Sector, the Vigilus System, the Prosper and Rift, and numerous other war zones, upholding their name as some of the Emperor's fiercest defenders. Raven Guard. Masters of clandestine warfare and the art of the Shadowed Blade. When the Raven Guard engage in open warfare, it is already too late for their enemies. The bloody conclusion to a campaign of sabotage, guerrilla tactics, and targeted strikes is a peerless coordination of assets by which the Raven Guard apply exactly the right amount of power to utterly destroy their foe. A series of shocking and explosive deaths, followed by the hissing roar of jump packs, is often the first time a heretic or Zeno's force is even aware of the Raven Guard's presence. The chapter's sable-colored armor reflects little light, and its battle brothers are highly skilled in using their surroundings to their advantage. Remaining unseen, they slip through twisted ruins and alien undergrowth, silently merging into pools of inky shadow. To fight the Raven Guard is to swing blades at whorls of smoke and to fire at half-seen specters with increasing panic. When every piece of their strategy has fallen into place, then will the Raven Guard swoop, their blades slicing deep and their heavy guns piercing the enemy lines in a dozen places at once. The Raven Guard are one of the original brotherhoods of Space Marines who fought with the Emperor more than 10 millennia ago. Under their Primarch, Corvus Korax, the Raven Guard crafted their trifold path of shadow, mastering the doctrines of ambush, stealth, and vigilance. These principles represent the pinnacle of the Raven Guard's way of war, those which every battle brother seeks to perfect. Lord Korax was withdrawn and taciturn, traits his son inherited alongside his pallid skin and unsettling dark eyes. The Primarch spent his early years among indentured slaves on a prison moon orbiting the industrial world of Kaivar. Korax led the prisoners in revolt and broke the power of Kaivar's slave guilds. The moon was renamed Deliverance and has been the site of the Raven Guard's fortress monastery, the Raven Spire, since the Legion were united with their Primarch. It is a grim and somber citadel, due to near constant campaigns and a careful rate of recruitment. Many enormous halls gather dust in the gloom, and certain lofty towers, haunted by ancient rumor, are stasis sealed against intrusion. Yet the austere display belies the power within, and its inviolable redoubts maintain a menacing watchfulness. The Raven Guard spare no thought for displays of prestige. Function is all, and as a training ground, bulwark, and memory of their gene sire's legacy, the Raven Spire fulfills every function the chapter requires of it. Orax's experiences on Deliverance instilled in him a deep hatred of oppressors. To this day, the Raven Guard strive to liberate humanity from heretical tyrants and Xenos overlords. They break the chains that bind mankind's sundered and enslaved worlds, though they do so from the darkness with no expectation of glory. For the Raven Guard shun the kinds of acclaim and honors that are laid before other chapters. The Raven Guard's isolationist tendencies and inscrutable nature do not endear them to their allies. Their dour and laconic battle brothers are viewed as suspicious and uncertain figures, distancing themselves even from other Space Marine chapters. With their brooding mien and dark gaze, the Raven Guard are held by those human survivors who owe them their lives as much in fear as in awe. Yet there is no doubting the chapter's stalwart resistance and unwavering loyalty. For 10,000 years, the Raven Guard have shielded the Imperium fighting wars across the galaxy, from the dark heart of the Emperor's realm to the bleak fringes. Many of the chapter's operations are undertaken by strike forces of Vanguard and Scout squads, supported by squads of jump pack troops and other aerial assets, such as gunships and speeders. Such forces are expert at maneuvering behind enemy lines. There, they sow confusion and destruction, or prepare to sink their talons into the foe's rear lines at the very instant a more conventional Raven Guard attack strikes from another angle. Hunting from the shadows, teams of Raven Guard snipers mercilessly cut down fiery demagogues and savage Xenos warlords. Highly valued among Korax's doctrines was the belief that a leaderless enemy is an enemy already defeated. Decapitation missions and assassinations were coordinated with feigned retreats and skyborne strikes. These stunning strategies leave the enemy reeling and vulnerable to the final coup de grace, without unnecessarily exposing the Raven Guard. The chapter's doctrine espouses stealth and swift reactions over brazen and costly onslaughts. The Raven Guard understand firsthand the consequences of terrible losses. Some of their oldest legends speak in bleak and bitter terms of the darkest days of the Horus Heresy. Along with the Iron Hands and Salamanders, Korax and the Raven Guard were brutally betrayed on the black sands of Istvan V by former allies. Hardly anything is known for certain of those chaotic times, but the Raven Guard were massacred and almost wiped out. After that terrible day, scattered bands of Raven Guard fought a shadow war against the forces of the traitors, making them pay in blood for every step they took towards Terra. Not all the Raven Guard's missions are undertaken subtly. After a careful reconnaissance by infiltrating squads, a shadow captain may deem a decisive strike of sudden and precise force is necessary. Shock troops are revealed in terror-filled storms of noise and death. Flights of jump troops descend from the skies, heralded by gunfire and crackling lightning claws. Such a strike shatters the foe's strength before they are aware the fight has even begun. As counter-strikes mobilize against them, these fast-moving squads have already withdrawn to strike elsewhere. Space Wolves. With the fury of a winter storm and the savagery of apex predators, the Space Wolves tear apart humanity's foes with instinctive aggression. The chapter is a brotherhood of heroes, hungry for glory and dedicated to defending the Imperium. Seeking to forge their sagas of honor, Space Wolves eagerly face down the most powerful enemies with ferocious snarls. Clad in storm-gray power armor that reflects the wide, tempestuous skies of their homeworld, bearing weapons hung with feral fetishes of atavistic power, and howling their savage war cries into the wind, the Space Wolves are among the most renowned and fierce chapters of Space Marines. With cunning strategies and hunter's instincts, they stalk the stars and seal the fate of all enemies of mankind. The Space Wolves are expert hunters and trackers, loping patiently after their quarry over battlefields across the galaxy. The hyper-keen senses of their battle brothers are more refined than those of other chapters. These are genetic traits inherited from their Primarch, Leman Russ, also known as the Wolf King. Russ fully embraced the tribal nature of his upbringing, and this culture forms an important part of the chapter to this day. The Space Wolves are divided amongst 12 great companies, each an autonomous brotherhood whose commanding wolf lord is answerable only to the master of the chapter, the Great Wolf, diverging far from the tenets of the Codex Astartes. The great companies are as individual as their lords, reflecting their commander's preferred methods of warfare. Each great company maintains its own ships, war engines, and specialist advisors that in other chapters are often drawn from centralized institutions. Every great company includes warriors who fight in what adepts of the Codex would recognize as every strata of strategic designation. In this way, each wolf lord is capable of taking the fight to any enemy. The warriors who answer his call, deploying in massed drop assaults, in roaring columns of bikes and battle tanks, in bands of heavy weapon specialists, or in swift groups of close combat killers. Space Wolves fight in tightly knit squads called packs. Maintaining their ancient traditions, most Battle Brothers fight with the same pack for their entire lives, building iron-hard bonds of camaraderie and honor that see them operate fluidly and instinctively as a whole. Individual warriors may be singled out for their glorious deeds and raised to the great company's elite packs of Wolf Guard. Or they may possess specialized skills and traits that are best employed elsewhere, such as in stealthy and taciturn packs of Wolf Scouts, or among aggressive and headstrong Sky Claws. Guided by the chapter's priests in their totemic lupine cultures, Space Wolves appear as barbarous and feral to their allies as they are terrifying to their enemies. Their giant warriors wear wolf pelts, runic talismans, and necklaces of oversized fangs, while upon their armor and leathery, weather-beaten skins are jagged icons, tribal tattoos, and warding sigils redolent of their harsh homeworld. The Space Wolves hail from the death world of Fenris, an icy planet of savage beauty, storm-tossed seas, and lethal predators. Its tribes of nomadic hunters endure age-long ferocious winters and brief seasons of fire, in which the world's scattered islands disappear beneath the waves, and new lands erupt after volcanic cataclysms. Only the permanently ice-bound continent of Asaheim endures, and upon its mountainous peaks rise the Space Wolf Fortress Monastery, the Fang. Native tradition forbids the tribes of Fenrisians from attempting to reach Asaheim, viewing it as a distant land of fierce gods. They are ignorant of the wider Imperium, and know of the Space Wolves only as mythical sky warriors. These armored giants, swathed in furs, may appear suddenly after a tribal battle and take with them those youths who fought with the greatest bravery and ferocity, never to be seen again. These banished heroes are never mourned, though they may have been grievously wounded when taken, as good as dead. Their kin know they now wage eternal war among the stars at the side of the demigods. This warlike pragmatism and indomitable spirit was instilled by Leman Russ in the Space Wolves and remains perhaps the greatest strength of his sons. The chapter's battle brothers are immune to the insidious tendrils of despair, apathy, and discontent, for they live the warrior's dream, an existence of daily battle waged alongside their brothers, punctuated by feasting and drinking, and at its end, a truly valorous death. Salamanders. Forged in the crucible of war, the salamanders are flame bearers and warrior craftsmen who hail from the volcanic death world of Nocturne. This brotherhood of onyx-skinned guardians has fought stoically to defend the Imperium for 10 millennia, wielding master-wrought weapons to hammer the foe into oblivion. The salamanders are the scions of the Primarch Vulcan, whose great strength, endurance, and skill in the forging and wielding of magnificent weapons is legendary. These traits, and many others passed into his sons, have persisted for 10 millennia. The chapter's warriors have skin as black as flawless obsidian, thought to be an unusual reaction between their gene seed and the as-yet-unexplained radiation on their home world. Coupled with the black orbs of their eyes, broken only by the ruddy glows at their center like lit coals, salamander space marines present a more terrifying appearance than other warriors of other chapters. Though they carry their unsettling appearance with a humble nobility, more than one insurrection has been quashed in its infancy by the sight of an unhelmed salamander advancing upon the ringleaders with red eyes blazing. Salamanders excel in short-range firefights, striding through storms of enemy shots in suits of master-forged armor. Each step forward is echoed by synchronized bursts of blistering firepower. They expertly employ large numbers of incendiary weapons, such as flamers and meltaguns, with which they burn their enemies out of the shadowed places of the galaxy and carve open their places of refuge. The salamanders prize patience and wisdom above all. Against overwhelming odds, they maintain steady advances until they are ready to meet the foe eye to eye. Then are the fires of their rage unleashed, and the famed strength of their gene sire visited upon mankind's enemies in blows from artisan-crafted blades and immense drake-headed thunder hammers. The salamander's homeworld of Nocturne is a fiery orb, strung with volcanoes, black plains, and sulfurous seas. Its higher crags are stalked by immense fire-breathing predators, from which the salamanders take their name. It was on Nocturne where Vulcan learned the art of metalworking, unlocking the secrets of fire and steel, the virtues of patience and honest labor. His sons continue to perfect these traits, and each battle brother learns to craft and maintain their own war gear with great skill. This allows the chapter's tech marines to focus on the repair of the salamander's large war machines and create technological artifacts of great beauty and perfect function. While the Salamander's Fortress Monastery sits on Nocturne's barren moon of Prometheus, the chapter's battle brothers maintain close ties with the human inhabitants of Nocturne. This perhaps explains why the salamanders hold in high esteem many of the human values that other space marines have distanced themselves from or simply forgotten. The chapter's culture draws on Vulcan's formative upbringing on the planet and places great emphasis on self-reliance, loyalty, and sacrifice. Salamanders maintain a great many technologies from ancient times, including unusually large numbers of hulking suits of Terminator armor. The Fire Drakes of the chapter's Veterans First Company often take to battle arrayed in such powerful war gear, and their personification of the Salamander's ideals recalls their heroic namesakes from millennia ago. The original Fire Drakes were Vulcan's elite warriors, and together with a large part of the Legion, they were betrayed during the opening stages of the Horus Heresy by those they had thought were allies. With a fraction of their Legion remaining, the Salamanders nevertheless proved a patient and enduring foe. Official records tell of no known successors to the Salamanders chapter prior to the Ultima founding. It is said that at the second founding, when Rabute Gilliman bade every Space Marine Legion to divide its strength into separate chapters, Vulcan secured an agreement to keep the depleted Salamanders whole. There have been many foundings since that time, and there are several chapters that share similarities in doctrine, organization, and physique with the Sons of Vulcan. Whether these chapters are successors of the Salamanders remains a matter of debate. During the Ultima founding, Archmagos Belisarius Kol used the true genetic stock of Vulcan to create Primaris battle brothers for the Salamanders. All Primaris chapters were also founded from this source, their warriors plunging themselves into the fires of war with the tenacity expected of all Vulcan sons. The Salamanders made swift contact with them, dispatching chaplains to each to instruct them in the Promethean cult. Iron Hands. Adherence to cold logic, intolerant of weakness, and utterly without mercy, the Iron Hands are implacable warriors whose resolve is as unflinching as solid adamantine. They are relentless defenders of the Imperium who seek to replace the weakness of the flesh with the unyielding strength of the machine to attain perfection. To the Iron Hands, the flesh is weak. Though many Space Marine chapters utilize bionics to replace body parts of their wounded that have been damaged beyond repair, the Iron Hands replace entirely functional limbs, organs, and digits with mechanical augmentations. Ultimate goal for a great many Iron Hands is to be interred within a dreadnought, which they see as the perfect alloy of the organic and the mechanical. To them, no destiny is more perfect than spending an eternity of war as a living machine. The Iron Hands inherited their disdain for weaknesses in part from the tribal culture of their homeworld, Medusa. Shrouded in a perpetual gloom, it is a death world characterized by jagged volcano ranges, rupturing geysers, and toxic pollution pumped into its atmosphere by the population's enormous land crawlers. Medusa's inhabitants are in a constant state of war with each other, fighting furiously over the planet's scarce resources. Such a way of life breeds a hardy and remorseless people. However, the greatest cause of the Iron Hands' intolerance can be traced to their Primarch, Ferus Manus. Indeed, it was his death that set them fully down the path of affinity with the machine. Ferus Manus was the first Primarch to die in the Horus Heresy. When he learned of Horus's treachery, he made for the Istvan system with all haste. On the ash plains of Istvan V, he surged into the fray without hesitation, consumed with wrath. In the bloody ambush by several brother legions that killed tens of thousands of loyalist legionnaires, he struck down traitor after traitor, and ignored the pleas to retreat issued by Vulcan of the Salamanders and Korax of the Raven Guard. For all of Manus's fury, he could not prevail against the odds stacked against him, and he was slain by the traitor Primarch Fulgrim of the Emperor's Children, who had once been amongst Ferus's closest brothers. The death of their indomitable gene sire caused the surviving Iron Hands much anguish. They blamed the Salamanders and Raven Guard for failing to support Ferus in his hour of greatest need. They blamed themselves for their own weakness, for not being able to reach their Primarch and fight by his side. They even blamed Ferus Manus himself for allowing his anger to consume him at the expense of sense and logic. The Iron Hands decided that they would purge this emotional weakness. Embedded as it is in organic flesh from themselves, so that they might never fall to its frailties as their Primarch did. As a part of this purge, the Iron Council was formed. Its nominated members each granted the title of Iron Father. It has led the Iron Hands ever since. The Iron Hands have no permanent chapter master. Instead, electing a warrior to lead the chapter if one is deemed required. The Iron Council adopted Rebute Guillemin's Codex Astartes, seeing it as the only logical course. Despite this, each of the Iron Hands' 10 companies retained the clan company names of the Legion, which are in turn taken from the greatest clans of Medusa's population. The Iron Hands held on to the tradition, despite its apparent superfluity. In its pursuit of perfection by purging the weakness of flesh from their bodies, the Iron Hands in time grew more reclusive and insular. It was only with the Adeptus Mechanicus that their ties grew, bonded by their reverence for machines and scorn for the weakness of the organic. This relationship has proven beneficial to the Iron Hands. Their armored vehicles and dreadnoughts are amongst the most mechanically resilient and best crafted in the Imperium. And their tech marines are taught secrets of the Omnissiah that those of most chapters will never learn. It is a great irony that this bond with the machine cults of Mars has been forged through shared passions rather than sheer logical necessity. If the Iron Hands have observed this, they have never remarked on it. To those that encounter them, the Iron Hands almost resemble automata, apparently despising such concepts as valor that drive so many of their brother chapters. Nonetheless, at their core, they are still of mankind, and emotion rules a part of their hearts regardless of their efforts to suppress it. In fact, such efforts merely draw it out. Their wrath is legendary. Their hatred for weakness is still hate. Their reverence of the machine is still reverence. When the Iron Hands go to war, they select the war zones they will fight in through ruthless utilitarianism. The Iron Hands perform the Calculum Rationale, a painstakingly detailed and ruthless calculation that determines the exact resources needed for victory. If these are not available for a campaign, they will not fight. On the battlefield itself, the Iron Hands often prioritize the destruction of the foe to the saving of the world they are fighting on. While this makes them lethal, uncompromising adversaries, for many it can make them poor, if not dangerous, allies. As the Great Rift tore across the galaxy and the population of world after world succumbed to waves of mutation and psychic maladies, the Iron Hands' tolerance for the flesh only grew weaker. They responded to threats in the manner they always had, however, with careful calculation. This had seen much of the chapter's strength deployed to the vital world of Vigilus, where they and the warriors from their Brazen Claws and Sons of Medusa successors have fought with distinction. They have deployed with such unfeeling discernment that those they have refused aid to have deemed them aloof and unreliable. The Iron Hands care not, indifferent to what they see as nothing more than the craven muling of the weak.